I work downstairs, in case you didn't know that. And in the downstairs, as well as I think part of the upstairs stuff, we're running the Saxon Math, hence all those little boards that you see back there. And Saxon Math is great. I love it. Teaches the kids to think. And so in the Saxon Math, one of the things that I have noticed, is particularly with some of the younger stuff, is that they try to teach them kind of how to work on word problems. I don't know how many of you did word problems in school. Generally speaking, it was the most hated thing. I remember is everyone just kind of, give me something where I just have to do some calculations. Word problems, no. But starting, I don't think I was in government school, so I don't think I ever saw word problems till high school. So I had reason to be afraid. But they're getting them very early on, and it's great. One of the things that I found quite interesting is they're actually teaching them how to think the things through. For example, I had someone this past week, he's working on division. And as they're working through division, they teach them first, underline the question that's being asked. So, whatever it was, I don't remember what it was right now, but the first thing they're supposed to do is when it says, how many, whatever, they're supposed to underline that. Then they're supposed to go back through and put brackets around the information that is given. Now, I like that because it's teaching them to kind of reason through and kind of go focus on the important information. Now, sometimes one of the things I really like is when they throw in one of these things. John had 15 brownies and 23 cookies, and Sally gave him 10 more brownies and 42 more cookies. How fat did he? No, that's not how it goes. How many brownies does John have now? Now, the thing I like about that is they threw in some extra unnecessary information all about those cookies that we don't really care about. They just want to know about the brownies. The kids have to learn to pull out the important information, kind of get those things down, and then they can work on the problem. There is a point to this. When it comes to the Word of God, you kind of got to do the same thing. I don't know how many of you, hopefully all of you, are incredibly familiar with the booklet, The Lord's Second Coming. I hope you're familiar with it because you've been actively teaching others through that. If not, I'm going to just keep my hopes. Okay? So, in The Lord's Second Coming, he does the same kind of thing. Those of you who are familiar with it, you'll know that the very first section are the six things that we know. Now, in teaching people through that, one of the things that I do is I kind of go back every week, no matter how far we get. As you go, the outline of it, you got the six things we know, then it goes through a discussion of premillennialism from the premillennialist point of view, and then it goes through the scriptural answers to that. Every week, even once we've gone through those six things we know, before I would start any study, I go back through and say, okay, now what are the six things we know? I kind of have you given the example of when you go wandering off in the woods. We went one time, only one time that I remember, looking for elephants in the jungle. I'm really happy we never saw any because I never saw any trees that were big enough with low enough branches for me to climb if we actually did see one. But we went looking for elephants in the jungle. Where's my wife? She's around here somewhere. Were you with us when we did that? But we weren't married yet, right? We were. Okay. We went looking for elephants in the jungle. And when you get into the jungle, and you actually, the real jungle stuff, you have no idea. Once you've taken about three or four steps in, you have no idea which way out is out. It's just everything's overgrown, and there's you can't even see anything. So one of the things that we did is we were going through, there's a big old group of us. I was with Jeff Hostetter. He had a machete with him. We call them cutlasses, but he had a machete with him, and he would make some marks and little arrows on the trees and make those marks on the trees as we kept going in so that we could find our way out when we wanted to get out. It's kind of what these six things that we know and the Lord's Second Coming, kind of what that serves as is those points on the trees to kind of get you out of the mess when you start getting into the mess. So you got to have those things to hold on to. So whether it's in math, whether it's in going through the Lord's Second Coming, or whether it's going through the book of Hebrews, see, I did have a point with this. You've got to come back to what do we know? There's a lot of stuff in Hebrews. It's jam-packed with all kinds of stuff. that you could spend years studying through. You know, I don't know how long you all have been on it, but as long as I've been here, you've been in Hebrews. And you're only in chapter 7. So you could spend a long time on it just kind of looking over this little detail and that little detail. I mean, there is tons of stuff in it. But the important thing is to remember the important things. You know, keep focused on what is the purpose, what are the points, what's he working on. Otherwise, you can really get caught up in this interesting point and that interesting point and miss the purpose of what it's all about. Okay, so quick review here. The book of Hebrews, Nick mentioned it last week. It's written primarily to the Jewish Christians who were beginning, you know, just a little bit before 70 AD when Jerusalem and the whole Jewish system was going to come crashing down. Everything that they had known, you know, and if you think that that's a small thing, just go back for a second to Acts chapter 10, if you will. You know, Ken, if I had agreed to let you hold this, it'd be a lot closer to me, wouldn't it? Be a lot more empty, too, wouldn't it? No, you have your own. Acts chapter 10. You've got Peter going to Caesarea as the angel had instructed him, you know, through all these or through the visions he had gotten these instructions. He goes to Caesarea to see Cornelius. Cornelius is a Gentile, has gathered all of his family together, a whole bunch of friends. Got a big party going on here. And it's the first original gospel rally. And so he's ready to, well, probably not the first. But anyway, he's ready to hear what Peter has to say. So, in verse 28, Acts chapter 10, verse 28, Peter begins to speak. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean." See, even Peter was struggling with the whole idea, you know, it's unlawful for a Jew. Peter still regarded himself to be a Jew, even though he was a Christian. This is, let's say, approximately 10 years into the church. And he still regarded himself as a Jew who followed Jesus. You know, which is why even you have the baptism with the Spirit happening or the immersion in the Spirit happening at Cornelius' house, just to kind of clear Peter's mind that these Gentiles, yes, they are okay. But the point is, for a Jewish Christian, even though he became a Christian, a lot, you know, he still held on really tightly to his Jewish heritage. You know, even you get over to Acts, let's jump it forward just a little bit, to 21, when Paul heads into Jerusalem, and this is years later, he heads into Jerusalem, and they asked him to take some guys who were doing these rites of purification, still this Jewish stuff, to take them in and do go through that with them. And he agreed. See, they still were holding on to a lot of the Jewish stuff. Now, sometime step out of your culture for a while and see how much you truly are an American. You know, having been in another culture for many, many years, you tend to be very perceptive of such things. You see it going on in others. You can even start looking at yourself. You know, I can tell you that even though I lived, you know, 13 years in Ghana, there still are some parts of me that the whole time I was there, I was still very much an American. Now, not a lot. I was being aware of it. Much of it didn't change. Or did change, sorry. Much of it I did change. You know, there are probably some parts of me that are slightly Ghanaian, which you probably notice those things better than I do. I might not even know it. Because once you get into your culture, sometimes you don't even realize it. So these Jews, I mean, they had been immersed in their culture. They'd known it. That's all they had known. And now they're Christians, and they're, the whole Gentile thing coming in, that was kind of shaking for them, but they're working through it, but they still regarded themselves as Jews. Okay, so they're getting ready to see their whole system come crashing down on their heads. And so the whole purpose of the book of Hebrews primarily is to point out to those Jewish Christians that they've got something better. So that when everything does come crashing down, then there's something better. There's something real to hold on to. You know, and that was the point that Nick was making last week. You know, if the day comes that America comes crashing down, we need to make sure that we're ready to help people and be ready ourselves, first of all, to know that there's something a whole lot better than the United States of America. There's a kingdom that we are part of that's much, much greater, and we need to be able to be aware of the differences between the two. That's something just to, you can think on that one a while. So back over in Hebrews then, what you've got going on, you've got this preparation. Now, it does serve much purpose for us today. I mean, the fact is, without the book of Hebrews, most of the Old Testament we wouldn't even be able to understand. We would have no clue what most of the Old Testament were about without the book of Hebrews. You know, you go through the book of Hebrews, you'll see quote after quote after quote after quote after quote. And all he's doing is he's going, see, this is what this is talking about, and this is what this is talking about. And he's just explaining. So it does have a lot for us, but primarily it was written to prepare those people for the collapse of the Jewish system and for them to see that they are part of something better. So if you get over to chapter 8, verse 6. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. More excellent, better, better. More excellent ministry, better covenant, better promises. See, that's the whole thrust of Hebrews is, hey, this new covenant, this thing that you're part of, it's a whole lot better than the old. So if the old just kind of dies, it's okay. It's okay because you got something better. You know, so as you go through the book of Hebrews, just see it from that perspective. See what he's working on. See that he's trying to make this comparison. It's a whole book of comparisons, comparing the old covenant and the things of the old covenant with the new. You've got this whole book of comparisons going on. So chapters 1 and 2, you've got comparing Jesus with the angels solely for the purpose of pointing out, and I preached on this a few weeks ago, so I'm not going to touch on it, say too much, but solely for the purpose of pointing out that the old covenant came through angels, new covenant came through Jesus, new covenant's better than old. The new stuff is better than the old because Jesus is better than angels. Chapter 3, you got Jesus is better than Moses because the old came through Moses, new came through Jesus, Jesus is better than Moses. Hence, the new system better than the old system. You get to chapter 4, you've got Jesus compared with Joshua. And the rest that he comes to give. You know, and the point was, you know, for those Jews, they could think, well, he entered into the promised land. Joshua gave them rest. That was their great heyday. And he points out that, no, even after that, it's talked about how there would be a day of rest. So that wasn't it. So Jesus is better than Joshua. Joshua was the one who brought them into the promised land. Jesus has something better. New is better than old. That's all you got working on. That's the end of chapter 4. Up through about where we're at right now, in chapter 7 and heading into chapter 8, is the priesthoods. The old-time Levitical priests, Aaron and all that, them compared with Jesus as our high priest. Jesus is a better high priest than they were. New is better than old. Okay. Anybody have any comments up to this point? Anything? Going once, going twice. I know. I don't think I'll remain lucky forever there, Stan. You know, the new guy comes in, you're kind of, can he handle comments? What's he going to do with these comments? You know, so it's okay. Hebrews chapter 7 then. We'll hit some things and then we'll head into 8. Here in Hebrews chapter 7, you have the winding up of the comparison between the old covenant priest, the Levitical priests, and the priesthood of Jesus. You've already established that he is of the order of Melchizedek, so he's a priest forever, greater, all that kind of stuff. And so let's pick it up in verse 18. Verse 18. For on the one hand, have any of you ever seen Fiddler on the Roof. Have you seen that? Some of you have seen that. It actually kind of goes with all this, and so watch it sometime. Every time I go through Hebrews, and I get to the for on the one hand, and on the other hand, I don't know if you remember the guy. I don't know. I don't even know his name now. You know, but he's always on the one hand, and but on the other hand, you know. So that's every time I read through it, that's what pops into my head. You know, sorry. I read it and it popped into my head, so I shared it with you. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness. That's the old. There's a setting aside of the old because of its weakness, its uselessness. Romans chapter 8 tells us that's because not because the law itself was bad, but because of the weakness of the flesh. But verse 19, for the law made nothing perfect. It just didn't have the power within it to make things perfect. It was good. It was right. It was true. But it didn't have the power to make things perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. Okay, one hand, other hand. Old, made nothing perfect. New, bringing in a better hope through which we draw near to God, which is one of the key things, is that we can draw near to God, part of the purpose of the high priest. Verse 20. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath, for they indeed became priests without an oath, but he with an oath through the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. Okay, now, the oath, it was inasmuch as it was not without an oath. Back in chapter 6, we touched on a different oath. There are two different oaths that's being talked about. Sometimes, you know, you got to pay attention to that one. Go back just for a moment to chapter 6. Picking it up in verse 13. For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. Okay. Genesis 22 is where that was made. So let's flip back to Genesis 22. What I want you to see is you got two different oaths being referred to here. Genesis 22. After Abraham had not sacrificed Isaac, but had laid him out there to sacrifice him, then Abraham's excited about it. Verse 15, then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. Verse 16, and said, by myself I have sworn. Which, by the way, just as an aside, just notice verse 15, the angel of the Lord is the one that's talking to Abraham. And he says, by myself I have sworn. So you can do your meditation upon who the angel of the Lord is there. Sorry. And said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Okay, there you have those promises made to Abraham. I will surely bless you. Yeah, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. Here it's bless you and I will greatly bless you and I'll greatly multiply your seed. You know, and you can look in Galatians 3 to see who that seed is. But, and who it is now. But we won't go there. But notice he says, by myself I have sworn. That's the oath. That's the oath. By myself, I have sworn. You know, when most people are making an oath, as he points out in Hebrews chapter 6, they do it by someone greater than themselves. Let's get that. Go back over to Hebrews chapter 6. Verse 16. Hebrews 6:16. For men swear by one greater than themselves and with them. An oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. Yeah. He says, with men, if you really want to settle things, you know, you have your oath. When I was a kid, it was cross your heart and hope to die. I don't know if any of you remember such a thing. Cross your heart. No, I know. I mean, still to this day, I don't really know what that means. You know, because at that point in time, I didn't hope to die. And I guess I'm closer to hoping that now. But, you know, but that was your oath. You know, you had to cross your heart. Okay, if you've done that, I'm going to have to believe you. See, he just pointed out the nature of men is that, generally speaking, men are such an untrustworthy, lying bunch of scoundrels that you've got to. We're back to the coffee thing, right? Uh-huh. You've got to pretty much have something to hold them to their word. You know, now I can honestly say I do not remember the handshake days where a handshake was settled and binding or anything. I'm not that old. Yes. However, I have heard about it. That's why, everything's got to be on paper. You know, we're in Bridgerview and we're trying to figure out they're making all their things. And I've got to figure out, I'm probably going to have to talk to a lawyer at some point in time just to make sure, but they've given these things in writing that says we have until the end of October of 2008. And I have to talk to a lawyer to find out if they've put it in writing, does that really make it binding? Or do I actually personally have to do a contract with them to let me stay there that long? You know, why would I have to do that? Why is that even a consideration? It should be that you just see it right there and that's good enough. They said it, that should be good enough, right? No, the nature of men is you've got to have some kind of oath. You've got to have something that's going to be binding. Okay, that's the purpose of the oath. So we swear by someone greater. God couldn't swear by anybody greater. I mean, who's he going to swear by? So he says, I swear by myself. Now, again, with the oath, remember the purpose. It's just to prove, if you get to verse 17, Hebrews 6:17, in the same way, God desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise. Who are the heirs of the promise? Just as an aside here. Us. Christians. The heirs of the promise. So to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, he interposed with an oath. Okay, so just, all this oath stuff, it's for us. It's God just saying, okay, you're not going to believe me unless I kind of cross my heart and swear to die. So here's what I'm going to do. By myself I have sworn, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply you. You know that it's going to happen. That's the whole purpose. So that when things start shaking, which is what he talks about later, this hope we have is an anchor of the soul. Believe it or not, we need anchors. We need to get held in here. And the storms do blow. And a lot of times you've probably watched a whole bunch of people get blown away. So we need this anchor. And so God's saying, okay, I'm swearing with an oath. This is really, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to multiply you. It's really going to happen. So, I'm kind of dealing with you at your level. I don't really, he doesn't really need to make an oath, but for our purpose, he'll do it. So that's the oath in chapter 6. In chapter 8, it's a different oath. Still the same point. This purpose is still the same for us to know that he's really serious about what he's saying. So in chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 20, and inasmuch as it was not without an oath, for they indeed became priests without an oath, that is, the Levitical priests. They were priests without an oath, but he with an oath, through the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever. Okay, there it is. The Lord has sworn. He's made his oath. Psalm 110. This is where the Lord has sworn, will not change his mind, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. This is the oath that's being talked about. So this is, you got two, Hebrews chapter 6, Hebrews chapter 7, the oath, two different oaths going on, but the point is still the same. It's to know that God's really serious about what he's saying. And so in chapter 7, they became priests without an oath, but he with an oath. So whose priesthood is going to be greater? The one who had the oath sworn about him that said, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Okay, this is really it. You're a priest forever. Okay, so that's your oath. Which, by the way, if you jump down to verse 28, you can see this. Hebrews 7:28. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law. Okay, the oath made in Genesis 22 was before the law. The oath that he's talking about here in chapter 7 came after the law. That's the one from Psalm 110 that he's making through David, at the time of David. And so, again, the whole point is, who's greater? Whose priesthood is greater here? You've got the old Levitical priests. They were made priests without an oath. But Jesus, priest, order of Melchizedek, priest forever. The Lord has sworn. He's made an oath. He's sworn it. Greater priesthood. Anything that you want to throw in here? Dan, I was going to say that I must be doing such a great job that it's just totally clear to everybody. Nobody, I've covered everything.
Yeah, I'm not clarifying anything. I'm just adding in at your invite. But the reference in 28 to the Son is again a reference to the high priest. So, right?
Right.
Yeah. So for the law appoints men as high priest who are weak, but the word of the oath which God oathed Christ. Which came after the law, appoints a son, again a reference to high priest made perfect forever.
I think you're going to go back in that also to chapter 5. We'll do a little bit of that as we go, as we move through this. But it's going to come up again. It is coming up again. Okay. Verse 22. So much the more also, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. See that better again? It just keeps coming back here. Better. So Jesus is the guarantee. It's by his high priesthood then. He is the guarantee. Back in chapter 6, you had the idea of a guarantee. Where'd that go? Chapter 6, verse 17, where it says that he interposed with an oath. That can also be that he guaranteed with an oath. Okay? In chapter 7, the guarantee is Jesus himself. He is, by the fact that he is the high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, by the power of an indestructible life, because of that, then, he is the guarantee that the covenant, new covenant is better. He's a guarantee of a better covenant. Okay? Verse 23. And the former priest, on the one hand, here we go again, former priest on the one hand, existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Okay, you've got the contrast again. Levitical priests, high priests, high priesthood of Jesus. On the one hand, the former priests on the one hand existed in greater numbers. There are a whole bunch more of them. Because they were prevented by death from continuing. Now, the death of the high priest. I mean, you had a whole lot of high priests coming and dying. And, you know, the whole point is, you know, you start working through one high priest. He's making intercession for you. He's offering the sacrifices on your behalf. You know, you might even be getting in tight with him there if you're a big sinner. And so you get to see him often. But, you know, you got him. He's making intercession for you before, for you on your behalf, or with God on your behalf, and then he goes and dies. Doesn't even ask your permission, he just goes ahead and dies. And some new guy comes in. And so now you got to go back through this. You know, and you can look through, you go through the Old Testament and look at some of those high priests. Things kind of went good or bad depending on where they were at. You know, if you got like Eli's sons, you know, they're going in and, you know, wasn't going to be a whole lot of good intercession going on if they ended up being high priests, which is why God said, bye bye. But it all depended on the high priest. Now, even in the Old Testament, there's another point where the death of a high priest is significant. You know, so you could either be sad about the death of the high priest, or you could be kind of happy about it. There were some who actually would have been very happy about the death of the high priest. If you go back to the idea of the cities of refuge, you know, you accidentally kill somebody, you know, like Ken for taking my coffee, and but it would be accidental. No. You know, but you accidentally kill somebody, you're out there working, axe head flies off, hits the guy in the head, he's dead. You know, you run for your life because his family's going to be hunting you down. So you're running, you got a city of refuge to get to. You're a fast runner. I would have died along the way, but you're a fast runner. You get to the city of refuge. The blood avenger shows up. He's ready to kill you. They hold the trial. They see that it was an accident. You get to stay in the city of refuge until the high priest dies. You are not able to be touched as long as you're in that city of refuge. Now, the high priest die. The blood avenger then has to just go home and go his merry way, even though he'd still like to kill you. You know, he can't do it because you're protected. They decided you didn't do it on purpose, so you're okay, but you must stay in that city. Now, when the high priest dies, you're a free man. When the high priest dies and there's a change, then you're a free man. You get to go out of the city. You get to be free. And again, the blood avenger can't touch you. If he touches you then he's going to be guilty of murder. So you're free. So there were some people who were really looking forward to the death of the high priest. You know, please die. Come on, when's he going to die? You know, because that meant that they could be free. See, the idea is you have a major change going on at the death of the high priest. Things changed. Now, establishing our point here that the former priests, on the one hand, they existed in greater numbers because they're prevented by death from continuing. It's just showing, you know, the weakness of having mortal high priests. It was a weak system. It was better than anything else that was going on, but it was a weak system. Is this a comment or okay? But he, on the other hand, because he abides forever, he lives forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Okay, which I guess in this case, if you're in a city of refuge, you don't ever get out. Of course, do you really want out of this city of refuge? Anyway, but in Jesus' case, he is, again, it's just establishing he's greater. They were prevented by death from continuing. So you kept having the continual changeover. Here you have one high priest. He's priest forever, permanent, because he's never going to die. So he can be priest forever. Now, I'm thinking that you would probably be glad that those old covenant high priests were never priests forever, because some of them you probably wouldn't want them as priests forever. Okay, so again, the contrast. On the one hand, you know, they were prevented by death from continuing. On the other hand, he lives forever, so he can be priest forever. Better. One is temporary, one is permanent. Better covenant. See, he just keeps driving that point home to these people so that they have something to hold on to when things get shaken up. You know, you think about it. America comes crashing in. You better hope that you have some things driven right in here about what's really important in life. America crashes economically. You better hope that you have something driven in here that the things of this life are not important. You know, the freedom in America disappears. You better hope that you have it. Okay, continues to disappear, disappears more, still more free than any other nation. But you better hope that you have it right in here. Driven in deep, where the true freedom is. The true freedom is found only in Christ. You know, so if, you know, in a sense, Hebrews is a book of hammering, because he's just trying to hammer the point home so that when things do come crashing in, people have something to hold on to. You know, and maybe that's good that we're studying it now. You know, not that I'm gloom and doom and America's going to collapse, but it's good to go through it. It's good to make sure that we know that this is better. This is it. Okay. 25. Hence also, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Again, still that same point. He always lives. You know, the high priest, he's there forever. He can always make intercession. And Nick talked about that some last week, so I'm not going to go on into that. But he's there. He's saving us forever, always making intercession. 26. For it was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. And he's going to get more of that when you get in chapter 9 about the whole offering of the sacrifice. But keep in mind here, he's working a whole section from the end of chapter 4. Go back to chapter 4 and make just a little bit of a comparison. There in chapter 4, you've got a whole section about him being high priest, and he's kind of winding it up here. He's doing a little bit of a Rick Vaught here. Tell him what you're going to tell him. Tell him what you told him. I'm not sure if he's going to sit down, though. I'm not sure about that part of it. But that's what he's doing. Chapter 4, verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need. So you've got there, he talks about, we have a great high priest who's passed through the heavens. You look in chapter 7, verse 26. It was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. See, he's coming back to that point. He's telling them what he told them. He's coming back to that point and saying, we have a high priest. He's passed through the heavens. He's exalted above the heavens. And just like he talks about in there in 4:15, he says, we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Chapter 7, verse 26, our high priest is holy, he's innocent, he's undefiled, and he's separated from sinners. Tempted in all things as we are, yet without sins. See, he just gives that same, you know, he's coming back and just hitting it again, kind of winding it all up. This is who our high priest is. We've got a high priest right up there. He's exalted above the heavens. He is separated from sinners. He has no sin. Tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. And then verse 27, there in chapter 7, he does not need daily to offer up those sacrifices, first for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people. In Hebrews chapter 5, he makes that same, he had already begun with this. Chapter 5, verse 1, for every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. See, he's already made these points. He's just coming back around and saying, this is who our high priest is. You know, so it's fitting that we should have such a high priest that doesn't need daily to offer up sacrifices for sins, because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. And he's going to expound, like I said, he's going to expound on that part a bit more when you get over to chapter 9. So then, 28, for the law appoints men as high priests who are weak. Okay, this is on the one hand, the law appoints men as high priests who are weak. They're prevented by death from continuing. They're beset with weakness. They sin. And so they have to offer sacrifices for themselves. The law appoints men as high priests who are weak. But the word of the oath, which came after the law, that is, that Jesus would be a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, appoints a son made perfect forever. Go back to chapter 5 again. See, this is so that you know that Rick Vaught was the one who taught the writer of Hebrews how to preach. Okay, well, maybe not. Maybe it's the other way around. Is it the other way around maybe there? No. Actually, Rick, you taught once about kind of how to do public speaking, when you're going to stand up, how to go about doing it. So you taught through all this stuff, and those were your points. You know, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. Sit down. you know. And I'm still looking at the time. I'll sit down when I'm supposed to sit down. But I actually had the guys in Sunyani listen to that tape. I really did. Because they need to learn when to sit down too. So it's a universal thing. You know, but it was something to help them. So that's why I'm maybe picking on you a little bit with it. But in my mind, this is equivalent with Rick Vaught, you know, that kind of way of thinking, which not a bad thing to have associated with you there, Rick. That's a good thing. That's a very good, clear thinking kind of thing and a scriptural thing. Chapter 5, then, after talking about the high priest being obligated to offer sacrifices for sins because he himself also is beset with weakness. In verse 4, it says, "No one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you,' just as he says also in another passage, 'You are a priest forever,' according to the order of Melchizedek." Okay, now what you have, you've got those two things being tied together. You are my son, today I have begotten you. And then you have, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. You've got those being tied together so that in verse 7 it says, "In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered, and having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek." So the sonship and the high priesthood, all that stuff is coming together, which should not be surprising to you if you know when Jesus was declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead, or when he was begotten. You have that, realizing that was what happened in the ascension to glory. That's the today that's being spoken of there. But then also, you're a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Same thing. When did he become a priest according to the order of Melchizedek? Same time, same place, same. So you've got all these things coming together all at once. And that's what you got in chapter 5. Chapter 7, then, he's just reiterating that. He's just saying, you know, what I told you before. Same thing. I told you before in more detail. I'm just kind of refreshing your memory on it. The word of the oath which came after the law appoints a son made perfect forever, and you saw that was through the suffering and then subsequent glorification. Okay, so that's the whole thing that's going on there, so that then you get to chapter 8, verse 1, you know, and this is all better, 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 you know, comparison on the one hand, on the other hand. Okay, so on the one hand, they were weak. On the other hand, you have a son made perfect forever. He's there forever. He's perfect. He's not weak. You know, he's not prevented by death from continuing, and he's not beset by the weaknesses that men have had with sin. He was without sin. So, better. Again, the comparison. So that chapter 8, verse 1, then he says, "Now the main point in what has been said is this." Now that should draw your attention. When in the Word of God it says the main point, you know, stop, hold on, let's pay attention to this. You know, because if he says it's the main point, we don't even have to try to figure out what the main point is. It's going to be told to us. Kind of nice. Main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest. What kind of high priest? Verse 26. "It was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens." The main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. And that there heads you into a long thing that I won't head into today, as much as I would love to. So the thing that I want you to see, you've got the comparison, and the final comparison, the old doesn't even come close. The old system, the old Levitical priesthood, they don't even come close. And so the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest. We have a high priest who is holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. You're just not going to get a better than that. So hopefully you're not interested in becoming a Roman Catholic now, and settle for a lesser priest than the high priest that we have. We have such a high priest, the best that you can get. And that's, you know, something for you to hold on to. When everything else comes crashing down, that's something that you can hold on to.